This episode is brought to you by the American Homebrewers Association, organizers of the 22nd annual Learn to Homebrew Day, coming up on Saturday, November 7th. Learn to Homebrew Day is an opportunity to celebrate and spread the joy of one of the most rewarding and delicious activities of all time. Pledge to brew this November 7th and receive a promo code for $5 off a one-year American Homebrewers Association membership. Visit homebrewersassociation.org to learn more. homebrewersassociation.org. Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, October 15th, 2020. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, Chris Colby, author of How to Make Hard Seltzer, Methods of Modern Home Brewing, and the Homebrew Recipe Bible gives us thoughts and strategies on pumpkin and holiday beers. That time of year! Chris also follows up on flavoring hard seltzer. If you go to basicbrewing.com, you can find archives of our audio and video shows. And if you go to basicbrewingshop.com, you can find our DVDs, our brewer's logbooks, and other Basic Brewing gear. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Basic Brewing and find our show page on Facebook as well. We have a cool Basic Brewing app on iTunes and Amazon.com, and we're found all over the place where fine podcasts are served up. If you want to support us financially, check out patreon.com/basicbrewing, and thanks to everybody who's helping out in that way. If you go to patreon.com/basicbrewing, you can see a long list of stuff that you can access if you sign up as a supporter. Financial supporters have already seen the next episode of Basic Brewing Video on my Porchtoberfest beer. I call it a Porchtoberfest because the ingredients were inspired by the thought of an Oktoberfest, Vienna malt and Hallertau hops. But the yeast is Kvike, Imperial's Pog, and the fermentation was started on the hot summertime porch. It was a delicious beer. I say was because it's all gone. The keg blew a couple days ago, which is good because it made room for my attempt at a Dampf beer or a German steam beer. I was inspired by my conversation with Adam Ross of Twin Span Brewing to brew a barley beer with Hefeweizen yeast. I used a 10 Lovibond Munich with a bit of a 20 Lovibond Munich for character and color, and again used Hallertau hops. It's not exactly what I pictured, but I think it'll be a good one to go into fall with, and I can't wait to share it with Steve. There's big news on the horizon from our friends and sponsors Ricky and Kelly from Groenfell Meadery. Ricky says they're about a week away from announcing their biggest, most exciting project of all time. He says 3 years or three millennia in the making, depending on how you count. It's called the Groenfell Ancient Collection. And Ricky says the bottles and the art and the mead itself, everything is based on centuries of inspiration. So I can't wait to hear more about that. As you know, Groenfell is an open-sourced, family-owned meadery in Vermont that produces delicious, drinkable, innovative craft meads that you can have delivered right to your home. And as you heard last week, they've added more states to their delivery list, including mine, Arkansas. That's a feat. That's an achievement. Groenfell and Chaos Meads are moderate in gravity, at least for meads, so you can take a can or two on a fall hike to a picturesque spot. You know, just have a little picnic there with some delicious meads. Just pack that can out, or, you know, just pick up after yourself. Be nice. Head over to Groenfell.com to see what's available, and stay tuned for that big announcement coming soon. That's Groenfell.com, Groenfell. Hey, don't forget to send in your disaster story for this year's disaster show. Steve and I are planning to get together and read them for the last show posted of the year. I've already gotten a few, but we need more. We're greedy. And if you're anything like I am, you'll procrastinate, so don't do that. Get them in while you're thinking about it, because I'm not sure when we're going to record the show. So just send your disaster story in now to james@basicbrewing.com. And the way 2020 has been going, surely there are some brewing disaster stories out there somewhere. Let's take a quick look into the mailbag for a non-disaster story. I got a fun note from a listener, Cameron. Cameron says, I work for Big Rock Brewery up in Toronto, Canada, and am constantly surrounded by new brew styles, but I've never seen us make a coconut beer before. I was wondering if either of you have ever tried making a coconut beer and what style you've gone with. Cameron says, personally, I tried to make myself a dry-hopped coconut kvike IPA. Turned out beautifully. Wow. Essentially, I just took some organic, unsweetened, shredded coconut, toasted it in a pan until browned, and put that into a nylon straining bag as a dry hop addition for about 6 days in secondary. The base beer I made was a mix of two-row, Pilsner, and a bit of flaked oats, hopped with Sabro, Azaka, and Medusa, then dry hopped with another ounce of Azaka for a 3.5-gallon batch. Used Omega Yeast Labs Hornendahl Kvike yeast as well. Cameron says, Sabro by itself already has a great coconut character to it, so I really wanted to see how the notes of coconut blended with the real thing. Definitely mixes well. That said, I did make a mistake by using shredded coconut instead of coconut chips. Cameron said, some of the coconut got through the straining bag. I didn't notice when bottling, and so I wound up having coconut flakes in every bottle of beer, doing a consistent long-term coconut flavor extraction. So see there, that was a potential disaster turned around into something good. He says, I have to carefully pour each bottle to avoid getting big old chunks of coconut in my glass, too. Learned my lesson and will use coconut chips next time. Well, that sounds fun and delicious, Cameron. I have brewed a coconut beer, not nearly as imaginative and adventurous as your take, but back on the January 6th, 2017 episode of Basic Brewing Video, I brewed a split batch of porter, putting coconut in one part and mole ingredients in the other, and also bottling some plain versions of that beer. And I was able to find shaved, toasted coconut in the baking aisle of the grocery store. So it was already toasted, and it was shaved, so it was these chips. And so it worked out pretty well for that purpose. And Steve and I liked it. So there you go. I did the obvious approach. Coconut porter. Not a Kvike coconut IPA, which sounds really good. Susan and I bottled the next malt sampler the other day that features black malts, Black Prinz, Black Patton, and Midnight Wheat. And boy, those were delicious. So maybe a black coconut beer is next? Hmm. Thanks for the note there, Cameron. Speaking of delicious beers, our friends and sponsors Desiree and Dave from High Gravity in Tulsa have a new ingredient kit that they're very excited about. It's called Solid AF Citra Pale Ale. And I'm assuming the AF stands for Actually Fantastic. Solid AF Citra Pale Ale is the first in High Gravity's Essential Hops series and a showcase of why Citra hops are a staple of the craft beer industry. It's got everything: citrus, grapefruit, lime, tropical fruits, and just the right amount of bitterness. And if you pick up Solid AF on highgravitybrew.com along with another kit, you automatically get 10% off at checkout. You might choose one of highgravitybrew.com's fall and winter seasonals, like Exaltation Christmas Ale, Ichabod Pumpkin Ale, Old St. Nick Ale, or Bubo McOwl's Wee Heavy. And of course, you can make your own recipe on the Build Your Own Beer page on highgravitybrew.com if you want to fly solo. And Christmas is right around the corner. Plant a seed in Santa's brain that a shiny new Warthog electric brewing system from highgravitybrew.com would look great under the tree. Check it all out at family-owned and operated highgravitybrew.com. That's highgravitybrew.com. Okay, I looked in the archives, and it's been a while since we've talked about pumpkin beers on the show. So I asked Chris Colby if he'd like to talk about them and add in holiday spice beers while we're at it. Chris Colby, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
Hey, James. Thanks for having me on the show. I feel better than I did 20 years ago.
That's good. It's getting cooler up here, or at least it did the other day. It's up back up into the 80s today. But, you know, it got me to thinking about fall type beers and holiday beers. And so I thought I would get together with you and just do kind of a pumpkin slash holiday slash spice roundup discussion of, you know, to kind of spark some ideas out there. But I want to address a couple of things. You know, you came on the show a while back and kind of slammed brown ales, you know, saying is kind of a worthless style. But you told me before we turned on the mic that you're considering actually brewing a brown ale.
Yeah. Mike McDowell, great guy, homebrewing legend, passed away recently. And one of his, so it's probably his most famous recipes, is Janet's brown ale. And so I was going to give that a shot. Because I you know, knew him a little bit. We, you and I, and John Palmer and Chris White, and he went to New Zealand a few years ago, and we hung out for a little while there at the New Zealand, the first of their now annual homebrew conferences. And so, anyway, just you know, gonna give that recipe a shot at some point.
It'd be a fitting tribute, and I take it that the recipe doesn't fit into the category that you were describing of brown ales that were kind of meh, or meh. Not cool enough to know how to pronounce meh. But I have a feeling that Tasty McDowell would not produce a meh beer.
His recipe is a little more hoppy than a lot of brown ales. And, I mean, that was one of the things I criticized brown ales for. It was just not being this or that. And, you know, but his recipe is a little more assertive, and it actually looks pretty good, and I'm excited to try it.
Well, there you go. Well, cheers to that, and here's raising a virtual glass to Mike Tasty McDowell and memories of New Zealand. And it would be nice to be down there now.
Yeah, they wouldn't let us in right now.
That's right. Okay, I want to bring you up to something. We talked about hard seltzers, and I told you my tale of woe and brewing the hard seltzer and having the stuck fermentation. Well, I followed your advice. I added the extra yeast. I added some yeast energizer and got the thing down to 10.03, which I tasted it, and I was like, okay, I'm done. This thing has been in the fermenter a month. It tastes good. I'm going to quit here. And I flavored it with some mango natural flavoring in the keg. And it tasted pretty good. So thank you for your advice on that. But I went out and I bought some White Claw mango to do some benchmarking. And I feel a lot better about my my homebrew example after tasting that. I said some disparaging things on the previous show about it, so I don't want to go into it too bad with the negativity, but... if your friends and family are drinking that stuff, you need to make it yourself and give them some of your better tasting homebrew version. But I got a question, an email from a listener who said that he enjoyed the conversation that we had about the hard seltzers, but we didn't talk about flavoring. So do you want to cover briefly about how people are flavoring these hard seltzers?
Sure. Yeah. On a commercial scale, they just use flavor extracts. There's, commercial companies that just put out, you know, flavor extracts for, baking and cooking and other beverages. And so it's just... On a commercial scale, it's just extracts of, flavor extracts. The nice thing as a home brewer, you can, you don't have to do those, although most homebrew shops now will sell that. You could add, like some fruit juice or, squeeze, lime is a popular flavor, so is a grapefruit. You could, squeeze some lime juice or grapefruit juice into your fermenter and just, measure it out. And so as a home brewer, you have a little bit more leeway. You can also, another thing you can do as a home brewer is if you know ahead of time that, you know, you're not going to either filter it or fine it with like enological carbon or activated carbon, any of that. You can add the fruit up front if you want, and that's going to help your fermentation a little bit at least. But, you know, the normal way to do it is you ferment the blank first and then add the flavoring to it. But as a homebrewer, you have options.
And I'm assuming that there are probably a couple of reasons. It's easier to just add the natural flavoring. And if you're a professional brewer and you want to keep down that calorie count on the can, not adding fruit add further fermentables and further calories in there might be a reason to make that choice.
Yeah. Flavoring, the flavor extracts are cheap and they don't even use that much, you know, and it's no calories or there's alcohol in a lot of them. So there is some calories, but there's no calories from sugar. And so, yeah, it's because the goal of making hard seltzers, the most of the U.S. brands, at least, it's to come up with a beverage with the lowest calorie count that still, you know, tastes acceptable and has enough alcohol to do something, you know.
Well, there you go. So let's move on. Boy, we're covering the agenda today.
Yeah.
Getting a lot done. It's like a Zoom meeting. The weather's cooler. We want to talk about pumpkin beers and holiday spice beers and other, you know, kind of beers to get us in the mood for the fall and the holidays. So let's start with the pumpkin. I mean, is pumpkin beer another beer that you're not looking forward to seeing on the shelves, or can there be good pumpkin beers?
I don't know. Pumpkin beers to me are a lot like pineapple pizza. I just don't care either way. Like I don't seek those things out. You know, it's not my first choice, but it doesn't bother me if other people like them or whatever. I mean, I could probably every year have like one pint of pumpkin ale, and if it's done right, you know, that'd be fine. You know? Neutral. And the one thing in my life that I don't have, just an opinion that drives everyone else away, is on pumpkin ales, and that opinion is drink them if you like them.
And speaking of neutral, pumpkin itself is a pretty neutral flavor. And in fact, I was looking through the archives, and way back in like 2009 or something, we had a couple of listeners on who did an experiment, you know, whether adding pumpkin to the beer, your pumpkin beer, actually makes a difference or not. And it seems like, I mean, it's been, you know, 12 years or however long, 11 years since I've listened to that show, but it seems like it doesn't make that much of a difference. It's more about the spices. So how would you, what are some tricks that you could use to actually give the pumpkin some flavor before you put it in your beer?
Yeah, a lot of pumpkin beers are just, it's just the spicing that goes along with pumpkins. There's absolutely no like actual pumpkin with them. If you were, you know, hell bent on that, find some squash that has an actual like decent flavor to it. That's close enough to pumpkin, only stronger. Stir that in the mash and, you know, you'll be fine. But yeah, the pumpkin itself in pumpkin beers isn't really what you're tasting. It's the cinnamon and the usual, cinnamon, nutmeg and allspice, the usual blend that you're tasting. And yeah, my only like advice on that would be to do it like any other, or a lot of other spice beers, is just put the spice in secondary, you know, ferment it, rack it to secondary, and you can put it in either as just the spices and let that soak in, or you could put the spices in like a small, you know, an empty spice jar that you've cleaned out and doesn't have any residual flavors or aromas. You know, put some spice in there, pour some vodka in there, let it sit for, you know, a week or something, and then you know, just use a tincture of the spice extract, the alcohol spice extract, and those are, you know, those are two ways that you can get it right. Mm-hmm. Quite a bit. You know, you can also, a lot of old school recipes have you throw the spices right at the end of the boil, and you can do that, but you end up, you know, you boil off a lot of the volatiles that way. And I don't brew a ton of spice beers, but the ones I do, especially later in you know, the time I spent homebrewing, tend to add it later and later in the process, you know, in secondary, or, you know, basically in the, you know, the bottling bucket or keg. Mm.
It's not like Indian cooking where I've been watching a lot of cooking shows. Mm-hmm. And they say that actually cooking the spices, you know, in, you know, kind of like stir frying the spices kind of in oil helps to, you know, awaken those flavors, you know, the strong flavors in Indian foods. So these spices that are used in these spice beers, maybe they're more fragile than the others.
The aromas are certainly are going to come off the spices. You might, you know, that would be a good experiment, actually doing a beer where you added everything in the boil, a second beer where you added half of it in the boil and half late, you know, like in secondary, and then one where you added all the spices late, because they're, you know, there could be something to boiling them. A lot of, you know, and a lot of breweries make spice beers, you know, with late spice additions in the boil. So, yeah, there's, and I would also suspect that in reality it would come down to the best way to do it might be a spice by spice thing, you know. Mm. For some boiling it might bring out a nice flavor. For others, it might just make a vegetal or you know, tannic. Let's go with tannic. a tannic character, or, you know. Yeah, the nice thing about adding it late is you always get all the aromatics. Whether, you know, if there's something more you could have boiled out of it, maybe. But you can get the you can get at least the aroma out of it. Mm-hmm. And then if you do an alcohol extract, you also might be getting some of the stuff, you know, besides the oils and the you know, volatile chemicals.
Getting back to the pumpkin, I've seen their Fossil Cove here in Northwest Arkansas. They have done a pumpkin beer, and they get a whole bunch of these. And you don't want jack-o'-lantern pumpkins. You at least want pie pumpkins. Mm-hmm. But then they cut up the pumpkins and they put them on a grill or into like an oven, and they get some caramelization on the flesh. So it's not, mm-hmm, just tasting like raw pumpkin, you know. There's some actual flavors in there. So that's one trick that you could use to, you know, to get some more interesting flavors into your pumpkin.
Yeah, raw pumpkin flavors is no good in a beer like that. I remember a few years ago, I got a bee in my bonnet that I was going to start growing giant pumpkins in my in my garden, and it's a wrong idea. I don't get enough sun. It's in the wrong. The real giants are grown, you know, far north of here. But anyway, I, you know, wasn't going to listen to reality, and so I set about making giant, you know, to grow giant pumpkins. And I got a few that were, you know, about the size of a, I don't know, 5 or 10 gallon fermenter or something. So I made a batch of beer, or a couple actually, inside of a pumpkin, using the pumpkin as the fermenter. And yeah, wow, they just tasted like uncooked pumpkin, and it was not, yeah, it wasn't any good.
Wow. Yeah. It doesn't sound good. And was it starchy because it wasn't mashed, or, you know, were there any other ill effects other than just the raw flavor?
As I remember it, both times I used like an old ale clone that was fairly dark in color. So I can't remember making any attempt to see if it was starch cloudy. I mean, I could have picked up some, certainly, but I don't recall.
Let's take a quick break from talking to Chris to talk about our friends and sponsors at Imperial Organic Yeast. You know we love Imperial with their incredible pitch rate in easy-to-open packages of 200 billion cells. My stir plate is dusty because I don't make starters anymore for moderate gravity 5-gallon batches. I'm spoiled. And we're collaborating with Imperial to build a collection of recipes on basicbrewing.com. Just go to basicbrewing.com/recipes and you can see the section and watch it grow. Right now we've got a cider recipe from Steve Wilkes of stevesbrewshop.com that features Imperial A40 GF Bubbles, which is a very clean and gluten-free yeast for your fruit-based ciders and meads. Bubbles is a seasonal yeast, so get some while you can. And I'm very excited about a Hefeweizen recipe from Gary Batliner, who works at Imperial and takes care of the yeast. It uses Imperial G01 Stefan, and I use that for my Dumpf beer, which I just kegged. Yum! Check those out at basicbrewing.com recipes and look for more each month. And I appreciate Casey and everybody at Imperial for helping us build that recipe section. And of course, ask your local homebrew shop about Imperial Organic Yeast. Check out what they've got to offer at imperialyeast.com. That's imperialyeast.com. Now, the times that I've been involved in pumpkin beer, I don't think I've ever made one myself, but Steve has made a pumpkin beer. And the pumpkin went into the mash. And I guess the theory is that those starches in the pumpkin can be broken down by the enzymes in the mash. But do you have to just add the pumpkin in the mash, or can you put it in the boil too?
You'll be better off putting it in the mash. Like, cook it to release all the starches, stir it into the mash good, and stir the mash a couple times during the mashing, and that's the best approach. You can throw it right into the boil, and you'll extract some starch, but you know, depending on what color and clarity you were looking for, and if you're cleaning and sanitation is otherwise, you know, well, a little extra starch isn't going to absolutely, you know, kill you. Although if you're a little lax on cleaning and sanitation, you know, your batch can fairly quickly turn sour or phenolic or you know, show some evidence of contamination. But yeah, you can put it in the boil if you want. It's just, I mean, you understand the consequences. You know that you're going to extract some starch. And depending on how much pumpkin you add, you're gonna add some haze. And I heard the kids say that some hazy beers are popular these days. I mostly just wish they'd get off my lawn, but they come to talk to me about New England IPAs and all this newfangled talk that just angers up my blood.
And milkshake beers are right out. I've heard the butternut squash is a good one too. In fact, I think there's a recipe, a reader supported recipe, submitted recipe on beerandwinejournal.com. And I remember seeing a picture of some butternut squash in there. So, you know, you can say it's a pumpkin beer. You know, it's in the same family. You know, it's a gourd.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, use more interesting squashes, bake them to get some caramelization in there, put them in the mash. Oh, I get another question from a listener a while back talking about wanting to make a potato beer. And, you know, you could put sweet potatoes in there. You know, sweet potato pie is kind of like pumpkin pie, or at least in the examples that I've tasted. So could you use sweet potato instead?
I've actually used sweet potatoes before in brewing and russets, different beers. If you make mashed potatoes, like or whipped potatoes out of sweet potatoes, which are actually, they're not a type of potato, incidentally, they're in the genus Ipomoea. But anyway, if you make mashed potatoes from the sweet potatoes, stir it into your mash, you get like a beautiful orange color to your beer, but basically no flavor. I had a pale ale that I made. I think it's actually in one of my books, the recipe for it. And I brewed it 3 or 4 times, and it was always great because it looked just this, you know, sort of deep orangey color that it's harder to get from, just straight crystal malts. You didn't really detect the flavor, and otherwise it was like a pale ale or an amber ale, and that's really cool. So yeah, you can use either potatoes or sweet potatoes. And I mean, the thing is, you can use them like as about 10% of the dry weight. Yet you have to do some calculations and figure that a potato is about 80% water. So to calculate what take the wet weight and calculate the dry weight, and you can add like around 10% of the mash if you're just using sort of continental malts or English pale malts, that kind of thing. But if you use US 2 row or US 6 row, very highly enzymatic malts, you can make up to about 30% of the beer, the dry weight, as potatoes. And then you have to do a little mucking with the water to grain ratio, because when the potatoes have there's water in them. And so if you throw them in after calculating the dry weight, but you don't take into consideration all the water in there, you get a little bit thinner mash, which, I mean, it's not the end of the world by any stretch of the imagination, but something to consider if you become a dedicated pumpkin or a potato brewer.
And the specific question that this reader had was, how do I make a potato beer? How much 2-row would I add? And I said, well, you might want to follow the example of distillers and add some amylase enzyme in there, to break down the starches in those potatoes. So, I guess if you wanted to make go beyond the guidelines that you're talking about, you could, add some extra enzymes in there to break down those starches.
Yeah, if you're making a beer, it was going to be like, say, over 40% potato by dry weight, then yeah, start adding some of those enzymes. Homebrew shops sell them. They're the enzymes that they use to make dry beers or light beers. And there was actually just random anecdote. There was a brewery during World War II, Lucky Brewery, that due to rationing, it was World War I or World War II, I can't remember, one of the two, that used potatoes in there. They made a regular sort of international style Pilsner or American style Pilsner, but they couldn't get their hands on corn, in the amounts they needed or as regularly as they needed. So they used russet potatoes in their formulation.
And I guess that would what effect would that have? Just dry out the beer or some?
It'd be almost exactly like adding corn, just without the corn flavor, or rice or potatoes. They're all basically a ton of starch, very low protein, very low everything else.
A potato beer. That'd be a fun little experiment to do. So let's talk about the base beers. For a pumpkin beer, a certain style comes into my mind, this kind of copper color, beer to kind of go along with the pumpkin theme. So what kind of a base beer, Do you have to brew, or should you brew, to go along with the style of these pumpkin beers?
Yeah, the standard sort of, you know, amber ale with the hopping dialed down a little bit is, you know, or at least was the sort of standard brew pub interpretation of that for the longest time. I mean, you can do other things. You could take like an old ale or, you know, any sort of darkish beer, brown ale, porter, stout, and add it to that. And just, you know, as long as you, yeah, just think about how you want the spicing to be. Do you want the spicing to be, you know, the thing that you notice on top of everything? Do you want the spicing, you know, just, you know, to blend in with the other ingredients? Or do you want the spicing to be, you know, it tastes like, you know, if you're brewing a porter, say it tastes like a porter, but, you know, with a hint of these spices. Yeah. So you can vary it up. The standard, you know, sort of amber ale interpretation is, you know, people like that because it's, you know, it looks kind of orangey. Pumpkins are orange, you know.
And then, you know, if you're just going to do a spice beer and not have to worry about whether it's a squash beer or pumpkin beer, it's limitless in my mind, you know, as far as, you know, you could throw spices into just about any color beer.
Yeah, you could. It's just how well are they going to work, you know? Like if you brewed, like I don't think a pumpkin spice Hellas sounds very good. It just sounds like the spices would just dominate it, and you'd lose. Like the nice thing about a good Hellas is that it's, you know, it's not intensely flavored, but it's well balanced, and you can taste, you know, the nice little bit of graininess and all that. And so, you know, I think there are some subtle styles that pumpkin spicing would just sort of roll over. Or else you'd have to work really hard to get the right balance, which is in spice beers. I've for years when I was judging homebrew contests, I would be on the Shiv panel, spice, herb, and spice and urban vegetables, spice, herbs, and vegetables was the category. And, you know, so I've tasted a lot of homebrewed spice beers. And like the biggest problem with them generally is just not hitting, not getting a level that's pleasant. And, you know, I think from my limited experience with brewing spice beers, it's because spices are, they don't come with a, you know, an alpha acid rating, you know, essentially, or a rating of what, you know, if you're using, you know, hot peppers, they have a Scoville rating, so at least you have some idea. But most spices, you have like no idea, you do from tasting them, but you don't have an idea from year to year of how is one teaspoon of cinnamon going to compare to the teaspoon of cinnamon you added last year, you know, in terms of the amount of flavor and aroma you're going to get out of it. So,
and that one teaspoon may have come from the same little jar. You know,
yeah,
we've all got those spice racks, you know, with, I remember growing up in the 70s, every home had a spice rack, and most of them were dusty, you know, because a lot of those spices don't get used, except like maybe once a year to make those spice cookies or something. So spice, you know, whether your spice is fresh or whether it's been, you know, stale in those little McCormick jars for, you know, 5 years, it could make a difference as well.
Yeah, makes a huge difference. And about the only thing, you know, that I've ever come up with to sort of deal with that is if you brewed, you could brew the base beer and brew like a double batch, essentially, and then add the spices to the one, add pretty much what you think is the right level, or maybe slightly over. And then taste it when it's done. And this, you know, this would be, you'd have to add it in secondary. And then just use, if you need to blend it down with the other one, use that. But that's going a distance that a lot of people probably don't want to, you know, deal with. You just want to throw your couple of teaspoons of cinnamon in and have it be right.
I mean, the good news is that spice flavor in beer does fade over time. if you hit it too hard, You know, like my fruitcake barley wine that I made with ingredients from a fruitcake, you know, is pretty potent. It's pretty strong when it's fresh. But, you know, a few months, in the bottle, and it tends to kind of, there's a curve. It kind of mellows out over time. So, yeah, finding some established recipes is a good example, you know, a good way to find the proper spicing. You know, let other people do the experimentation for you.
Yeah, and one thing I would recommend is look at a variety of recipes, look at the amount they added, and if they, you know, a lot of times in the recipe they won't specify, like, what intensity of spices they were shooting for. But look at all the recipes, take the lowest value, maybe subtract 15% from that, and use the absolute freshest spices you can get. Like, go to the store. If you're lucky enough, like my local supermarket has a spice thing where you go and you just measure out however much you want out of this out of a bulk spice thing. And those are usually, I mean, they go through those constantly, so those are very, very fresh. And if you know, use the minimum, you know, or look at, you know, as many recipes as you can, and look at on the very, very low end, take that amount, and then, but to use the absolute freshest spices, and that's not infallible, but it's, you're not likely to go horrifically wrong.
And know what you like, you know, because if you don't like cloves, don't put it in the beer. Just because it's in the recipe doesn't mean you have to use it. I like your tincture idea, though. I like your idea of, you know, making like an alcohol-based tincture and soaking those spices in there for a few days. You know, that way you could taste the tincture and then dosing it into the beer, say in the bottling bucket or in the keg. You can actually dial in those spice flavors accurately, you know, exactly the way you want it, you know, when you're packaging.
Yeah, I wouldn't really remember or recommend directly tasting the tincture, because that's usually pretty intense. But take, you know, pour out a pint of beer or something, and if you have a dropper or something, you know, add a drop or whatever and taste it. Is that a good, you know, two? And then, you know, once you get to a level that's pretty good, maybe subtract 5 or 10% from that, and then do the math to figure out, well, you know, 16 ounces is to 5 gallons, which I'm offhand, I don't know how many ounces that is. As you know, this amount of this many drops is to how many, and then calculate that, how much volume you'd have to add to your 5 gallon batch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, might be a good way, or a good reason to switch to the metric system just for that.
Yeah,
for that exercise.
or if you wanted to go super nuts, pour out like, you know, I don't know, 4 or 5 or 6 like 2 ounce servings, and then take, you know, maybe 1 drop in the first, 2 drops in the second, 3 in the, you know, do a panel that way, And if it's just way too strong, then just dilute them all by half again, you know, assuming you've taken the same amount out of each in the sips, and you could do it that way and then scale up. The nicest thing about making the like an alcohol tincture is because you can, you know, if you show some care, you can get your spicing level pretty much like exactly where you want it, because you do your, you know, your test of how much you're going to add. And then you add it.
And you should be shooting for drinkability. You know, you're going to wear out your tongue if you make the beer too heavily spiced. You know, you want people maybe wanting another pint in addition to the one that they just, you know, struggled to get through.
Yeah.
They're sucking on a potpourri bowl or something. But,
yeah. Unless you submit it to a contest, then you sort of want it to just knock the judges over. Because if it's spiced, you know, just right and perfectly balanced, they're going to say they can't taste it. Because, you know, the beer's just going to be stacked up against a little bit, you know, very, very spicy.
Right. Well, there you go. Anything else for the cause? I think we've run through the agenda.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, I think the overwhelming problem that people, the brewers encounter with spice beers is getting the spice level right. And I think the problem there is mostly that spices are, you know, depending on the growing conditions, where they're grown, which year, they're different strengths at different times. So a recipe that calls for one tablespoon of some spice per 10 gallons or whatever, you know, if you follow that recipe exactly every year, you're going to get a different beer depending on, are you using fresh spices? Where were they grown? What were the conditions? All that. So yeah, which is also sort of the nice thing is if you get it absolutely right, then you can feel pretty good about yourself as a brewer. Cause you know, that's tricky. And you know, you got the spicing level right.
Yeah. Or you could just be like Anchor and say that their recipe for their holiday beer is different every year. So
yeah.
If you're shooting to make the same one every year and you miss, just say, hey, this is this year's edition. Live with it.
Nice.
All right, Chris. I appreciate it. Happy fall.
Yeah, happy Halloween coming up. Thanksgiving. So,
yeah.
Very exciting.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Well, thanks again to Chris. Be sure to pick up Chris's book, his latest book, How to Make Hard Seltzer. And make some hard seltzer that's actually good for your seltzer-loving family and friends. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com, or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Check out our mobile-friendly shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody supporting us through our Patreon page. Special goodies coming your way. Check that out at patreon.com/basicbrewing. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer, production host for Basic Brewing Radio, and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. In the meantime, stay well and stay tuned. So long.